Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the STEM Dadian Network. I'm Charles Mudd, the host of STEM Voices. With STEM Voices, we want to bring you, the listeners, young, old, anywhere in between, the voices of those individuals contributing to the advancement of science, technology, engineering, math, and so many related subjects. We believe that we should all encourage young girls and boys, men and women, to pursue those opportunities in STEM-related fields. We live in exciting times. No longer are trips to the moon or colonization of Mars simply the imagination of science fiction. They actually happen to be the topics of real discussions. We explore and learn new planets. Science is bringing us so many advancements. These are indeed exciting times. And to that end, we hope that our programming might encourage, might inspire any one individual out there, perhaps you, to explore things STEM-related. With that, I hope that you sit back, relax, and enjoy this broadcast of STEM Voices on the STEM Dadian Network. Today, I'm really excited because I have two guests. Both are involved with Yosemite Space, and we're going to be talking about some really, really exciting and for me, cool topics. I have Dr. Kathleen Morse and Jeremy Zawadny. Welcome, both of you, to STEM Voices.
Thank you.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So, I'd like to give the listeners a little bit of background about both of you, and particularly Kathleen, your background, and then how you came to be at Yosemite Space. I know that you did your bachelor's in science at MIT, and then moved out west to Colorado. And obtained a master's in aerospace engineering. And then you moved further west to Stanford in California to get your PhD. And soon following that, you ended up going to Lockheed, which we can talk about, Lockheed Martin, and then starting the entity that is now Yosemite Space. But let's go even further back and ask you how you went on that journey. But you're the majority owner and founder of Yosemite Space. And Jeremy, you actually went to Bowling Green State. My brother went to Bowling Green State, and I visited that campus a few times. And you have a degree in computer science. And so we'll also want to discuss how the two of you came to work together, or how, Jeremy, you came to join Yosemite Space. But before we get into that, Kathleen, how did you get interested in science? What sparked your interest long ago or recently, or when was it that you knew that you wanted to do something in science?
Well, some of the earliest memories I have are walking outside with my father in the evenings where we lived in upstate New York, and he'd point out to the stars in the sky and explain that these were different worlds, different than our planet, and other planets different than our planet, that were, equally fascinating, and places that, just had phenomenon on them that would be incredibly interesting to explore. And then over the same period, Cosmos was on PBS, and I would sit down with my brother Jeff and my father and be watching some of the episodes of Cosmos, and I saw Carl Sagan in The Ship of the Imagination, And at that age, I thought, we are actually doing this. We're going to these worlds my father described when we would walk outside at night. And, you know, it was only later that I realized, oh, we're not that far ahead. But that was really the early seed for me. And I could see what was possible, even though these were points of light in the sky. This was, you know, a whole area ripe for exploration and discovery. So, you know, I've seen throughout my life, you know, there is possibility out there. And, you know, that's fueled my desire to continue to help to progress aerospace. Because, you know, I agree with many others that think that we should explore off this planet to other planets and potentially at some point in the future other solar systems, because, you know, this is on the edge of our exploration and pushing beyond the human potential, is to really step beyond the Earth and to explore other worlds that are available to us.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I think that this is an exciting time to talking about that, particularly as commercial space exploration really seems to be taking off with SpaceX and Jeff Bezos' project and so forth. But let's take a step back. And you mentioned, you know, your father being an impetus and going outside. Were there any kind of role models going through school, whether high school or earlier or college, that really kind of encouraged you or pushed you along in that regard?
So that's a really great question. I cannot point to a particular role model, but people who explore, either, you know, pioneers in science, or pioneers in going to the South Pole or the North Pole, people who come against obstacles and don't stop but continue to push forward or find another way around and do the things that are not imaginable by most, but see it as possible and then actually succeed at those goals. You could say that everyone who I encountered growing up who accomplished these things that I read about in books or heard about on TV or other places. I mean, just generally people who are able to do this has been an inspiration to me. And it always told me that, you know, basically what we think, what we potentially can see as possible, even if others can't clearly see it, there could be a way. And it's worth trying to get there to the other side of the obstacle. So that's, you know, generally how I was inspired growing up is seeing others doing things that most would not think are possible.
Well, and I have to say from my own perspective, I think you are now one of those individuals because...
Oh, that's, you know, very kind.
It's absolutely accurate in my mind because you talk about going outside, looking at the stars with your father and... For that young girl back then to look up and now at this point be working on technology that actually is and may be tested outside the International Space Station and working on those kind of things. And, you know, the founder and principal owner of Yosemite Space, I mean, that is, if there's any kind of... if there's any kind of inspiration, that's definitely an inspiration to go from point A to where you are now and kind of leading along with those people that you were just describing as taking those opportunities, exploring and going out there. But I, you know, after school and you went to Lockheed Martin, which obviously is a big name in aerospace and space technology and so forth. How did you happen to get to Lockheed Martin following your PhD? Did you work at all between getting your bachelor's degree and completing the PhD, or was it basically an academic track until the end there?
Yeah, so I started doing internships at places like Bell Labs, Murray Hill in New Jersey, while I was at MIT. But basically, I did go fairly straightforward with my education. And just to clarify, I got my master's and PhD from Stanford, and later I did the degree in aerospace at the Colorado Boulder. But yeah, primarily I went forward with an academic track, and I did do a short postdoc in physics, working on cryogenics. But when I went to Lockheed, as you know, when you get a degree, it's only the beginning of the learning process, and so I continued to learn a lot at Lockheed. It was really wonderful for training. It actually provided wonderful training for how to understand how to have a concept and go from the concept into building a product that others would want to use. And so I was working at Lockheed on advanced research in several areas, including metamaterials and nanocomposites. And that gave me a lot of understanding that I've later benefited from when starting my own business.
You know, I want to go back to the correction that you made just a minute ago, because you're right, and I wasn't looking at the timeline there, but you did go, and obviously you'd be right, you were the one who went to school, but it's your degrees that we're talking about, but you completed your PhD from Stanford in 2003, and then you went to get another, to get a master's later in aerospace engineering. What prompted you to do that after having obtained the PhD?
Well, so when I started my schooling, actually my brother went to MIT before me, 9 years before me, and he actually encouraged me to go into physics or material science, which I later did, because at that point the aerospace industry and the hiring in the aerospace industry was not looking very good. But even while at MIT, I interacted with the aerospace department. While at Stanford, I was SEDS, Students for the Exploration and Development of Space. So I kept active in my interest with aerospace, but I was struggling with this idea that I could get a degree in aerospace, but I may not have a reliable job. That picture was given to me by my brother. And I did find material science and physics to be incredibly interesting, so I'm glad I did that. But then I went on to Lockheed, and I needed to integrate these advanced concepts into aerospace products. And I didn't feel like I had a good foundational understanding of aerospace systems to the point at which I felt comfortable with. So I did start taking classes at the University of Colorado at Boulder, and it really helped to fill in any gaps in knowledge that I had. It just helped me to understand the bigger picture of how to integrate things into space products. And one of the significant things that I did get through Lockheed and through University of Colorado at Boulder was understanding what is required of products for them to work reliably in space. And that is where using ruggedized technology such as is used in cell phones, how critical, or actually how there's a lot of crossover between, what we're currently using on Earth and what potentially could be used reliably in space. So I've been using the knowledge from both Lockheed and developed from these additional classes I took in aerospace at Boulder to basically effectively understand the needs in aerospace.
Very interesting. And if you don't mind me asking, one question that I'd like to know is, was Lockheed, since going and getting that master's or taking the classes to get the master's in aerospace engineering, overlapped with being at Lockheed, did you do that while working full-time as well for Lockheed? Were they supportive of that?
That's an interesting point. I talked to management at Lockheed because I did, you know, ideally I would love to take classes in aerospace, work on a degree while also, you know, being a full-time employee, and they did not support that. So I actually paid for the classes that I took in aerospace out of my own pocket. They just laughed. It's one of the people at Lockheed laughed at the idea of me getting a degree in aerospace. And so I won't say that that is generally their philosophy, but they felt like since I had a PhD, why would I need another degree? And some people learn very quickly on the job, but in the area of Lockheed that I was at the Advanced Technology Center, I didn't have a lot of opportunity to interface directly with these aerospace programs. You know, it's at the level that I think I would have understood the full aerospace system better. So I was proactively trying to understand the big picture.
Sure. So, go ahead.
Oh, no, that's all I wanted to mention.
Yeah, and I mean, so much the better that you did, right? Because sometimes, you know, it's things may happen in a particular way that we don't fully understand at the time, but now... look, you completed the degree, and it kind of moved you back into the space, aerospace area in particular. And now you have somebody's space. And I know that you started, it had a different name at that time when you first started, Advanced Materials Applications. Am I correct on that?
That is correct, yeah.
And so how did that come about? You're at Lockheed, and Jeremy, we're getting to you. Hold on, we'll get there. But how did that come about? You're at Lockheed. You're taking the classes. You're funding your way through taking those classes yourself, your own way. And then what was the spark that prompted you to go off on your own to start at that time AMA that's now Yosemite Space?
Well, I was very fortunate. Jeremy Zawadny, who's also my husband, he strongly encouraged me to follow my dreams, and that he was going to support that. So that made a huge difference. And his background, I don't want to touch too much on your background since it'll be summarized later, but he came from Yahoo and he interfaced with a lot of startup companies, and he too has the space exploration bug that I have, and so he helped me to basically think outside the box of academia, think outside the box of the large company organization, and to not be afraid to start a startup and not to be afraid to potentially fail. But to really, paramount was to do the things that, you know, my heart called me to do. And, you know, this bug of loving exploration, being fascinated by aerospace and what's possible to do in space, that just never went away. And so instead of, you know, working up the management chain or getting further promotions within Lockheed, I really made a clear choice that I was going to take the risk, quit my job, and basically start my own startup. And at first, because my focus had been in advanced materials technology, I thought I'm going to call this company similar to what my background is. And at that time, I didn't have any specific aerospace products in mind. So I was trying to keep the door open to a lot of possibilities. After I started the company, soon after that, I got a call from someone who told me about CASIS, the Center for the Advancement of Science in Space, and opportunities to fly technology outside the International Space Station. So basically I applied to that, and that was the first grant I applied to as my own company, and we won this. And this is what later became the Gumsticks project.
All right. Well, let's take a walk back a little bit. And so you mentioned that beyond just working together, you and Jeremy have you're married, and I understand that dynamic, because I tell you that I would not be able to do things that I have been able to do without Catherine, my wife, being supportive and sometimes giving me perplexed expressions, but nonetheless being supportive and on the way. So how is it that the two of you came together? And Jeremy, you do have a really interesting background and pedigree, coming from, you know, computer science, and then the companies that you have worked for. I believe, you know, Yahoo's in there, Craigslist. So how did you go from Bowling Green State out to the big companies that we hear about in California? And then how did the two of you come to meet and get together?
Sure. So I was at undergrad at Bowling Green State University, I was looking at co-op and internship type opportunities, and I found one with a local company. One of the bigger companies in that area was an oil company, Marathon Oil, and this was at a time when a lot of the internet stuff was really just starting to take off, and a lot of big companies were talking about doing things on the internet and setting up their own intranets so that employees could share information better and all that. And I just happened to be at a job fair and went to a booth for Marathon, and the people who were at the booth there were from the IT department, and we got to talking, and they sounded like they might have you know, some use for someone like me and some interest in the kind of stuff I did, because I was really getting into the whole Internet and World Wide Web and all the technology around that.
Sure.
Even though it wasn't really taught in school yet, I was kind of self-taught in that area. And so that turned into a co-op opportunity where I went to work for Marathon on a full-time basis for, I don't know, it was 4 to 6 months, something like that. And it worked out very well, so I continued there on a part-time basis until I graduated and then went to work there full-time. And they created a new group in the IT department called the ITG, the Internet Technology Group, and I was one of four people in that group when it was started. And I was there for a couple of years and helped get the company's external website online, the very first version of marathon.com, and worked on some internal tools for the corporate intranet and things like that, and just all the while seeing the possibilities and potential for web-based technology and making information available through a web browser rather than the traditional method of building desktop applications that have to get installed and all those support hassles that went along with that. But what happened is I kind of reached a point where I'd been there for a while, and they were excited to have me there because I was teaching people there new things, and I got to the point where I realized I was teaching a lot of people new things, but I really wasn't learning new things myself. And felt like if I wanted to continue to do more and grow, I kind of had to find something else. And so I had been programming a lot in a programming language called Perl. And I had learned that in my first co-op that I did. Even before that, I worked for the computer science department for about half a year. And I just happened to be on a mailing list for Perl jobs. And a posting came up from someone at Yahoo. This was back in 1999. And that person, little did I know, was going to be my first manager at Yahoo, because I responded to the posting and sent along a copy of my resume, and, you know, a week or two later flew out to California to interview. And before I knew it, I had a job offer, and I moved out to California in late 99, right before the big Y2K scare, and was working for Yahoo Finance. It was Yahoo Finance was the particular property on Yahoo that I used the most anyway, so I was very excited about that. And so I spent about eight and a half years there working on originally Yahoo Finance. I had a bunch of other jobs while I was there as well. But hopefully that kind of at least tells you how I got out to California and started to work for internet companies.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, back Y2K, actually that came up in a conversation with somebody not too long ago. I was trying to tell them about Y2K and that fear that many people had at the time that the double zero was going to cause all havoc. But you went from Yahoo to Craigslist, and are you still with Craigslist at the moment, or are you also or are you solely Yosemite Space at this moment?
I do still work at Craigslist. That's my full-time job. The work with the Yosemite Space work is sort of evenings and weekends and whatever spare time I can muster.
And Kathleen, does he give you enough time for that, or do you need?
Usually. As we also have a third member of the company, Ira Chapman. So he also, he was a colleague of mine at Lockheed, and he retired up to the same area near Yosemite where we live. So he also helps us with work here.
Excellent. So the two of you are in California, and then how did you run into one another, and how did you start to come on board, Jeremy, then with being the lead software engineer?
So how we met is kind of an amusing story. Both Kathleen and I are pilots, and we both actually started our flying hobby career as glider pilots. And I had learned how to fly gliders in Michigan when I was living in Ohio, but ran out of money before I could get my license, and continued taking lessons after I came out to California down in Hollister, California. And we kind of were met and were introduced through mutual friends of ours who were also one of them was a glider pilot at the time, and the other one was a student glider pilot. And that couple actually both ended up, one worked at Lockheed for a long time, and the other one ended up moving from Sun Microsystems to Lockheed. And so they kind of introduced the two of us, and we sort of met through a common interest, I guess you'd say, and
sure.
Both continue to do a lot of flying and whatnot these days too.
And was that long before Yosemite or Advanced Materials, or had you already started Advanced Materials at that time?
Well, that was long before. Yeah, we met 9 or 10 years ago, and the company only started up. I want to say Kathleen can tell you better. I'll guess 4 years ago, but she knows the exact dates.
We will be right back on STEM Voices with our guests, Kathleen Morris and Jeremy Zwodney of Yosemite Space.
Napa know-how.
A Napa guy knows more isn't always better, unless we're talking about full-size vans. These beasts do more than get you from A to B. They have so much space a man can live in it. With shag carpeting, waterbed, and a sweet lava lamp, these mobile abodes have all the comforts of home. With quality parts and plenty of Napa know-how, you can keep the original tiny house running longer, stronger. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how!
And we are back on STEM Voices, part of the STEM Daddy and Network, with our guests, Jeremy Zwodney and Kathleen Morse.
So you start Advanced Materials, and for those, and it was not only the name, you mentioned earlier that you kind of had experience working with Advanced Materials, and so you were getting into that space, and that kind of then led to the name of the company. But for those that don't know, when you discuss Advanced Materials, what does that mean?
Well, so basically Advanced Materials are... In many cases can be materials that are engineered to have certain material properties. So if you go back in significant eras in history, they've been the foundation of several eras have been based on a new material with specific properties, such as the Iron Age. And so in material science, we learn how to engineer materials through processing and fabrication and other kinds of techniques to specifically design materials to have desired properties, which could be thermal, chemical, mechanical, electrical, etc. And that is the foundation of enabling potentially new technologies to evolve, and one of which many of us are familiar with is silicon. You know, silicon is the element SI, and it has very desirable properties for the transport of electrons and holes through semiconductor devices and so forth. So what I did at Lockheed is I was working on engineering materials, what we call metamaterials, to have tailorable properties in the electromagnetic range of, you know, a whole range of different wavelengths. And what that would allow is for a lot of current aerospace products, such as tunable filters, to be miniaturized many, many orders of magnitude. And in space, it's often extremely desirable to have technology that's small in size, weight, and power consumption. And the other big issue with putting technology in space is you also need it to be very durable in the space environment and reliable. So that's kind of where I was coming at advanced materials applications, was looking at, what are the needs in aerospace and how could materials be integrated into applications to help enable this size, the miniaturization of size, weight, and power that's always desirable in a spacecraft.
Well, it's interesting, too, then, that leads to one of the things that I want to talk about and what Yosemite's working on, and that is, and you actually were on NASA TV or NASA programming talking to, I believe, high school students about this, too, and talking about, you know, the question, will your cell phone work in space? But I think the broader question is, and correct me if I'm wrong, how well does computer technology work in space? And I understand that, you know, from that, then we get to CubeSat and what those might offer. But am I right? And that's one of the broader concepts that would bring it, or more specific, to bring it home to the average person out there, is wondering the question, how will your cell phone work in space, or how will computers work in space? Is that something that you all are working on?
That's absolutely, yeah. That's been our early focus. So, the cell phone technology has a lot of ruggedized parts in it. And the idea is your cell phone has a lot of similarities to a spacecraft. It's small in size, weight, and power. And again, it's durable to being dropped, et cetera. And that's what you need in a spacecraft typically put in space. And so the idea here is we were focusing on the computing technology, which is oftentimes in today's cell phone and tablets a system-on-chip type technology. And so we have been evaluating a lot of different system-on-chip technologies in radiation testing that mimics the space environment that we want to fly in. So we do testing on Earth to then screen out any weak components before we test it in space. And that was the basis for GunSticks. Which is basically a gunstick is a computing board made by GunSticks. And the technology includes everything you'd have on a typical motherboard, including the processor, memory, et cetera. And so this was a big step forward in looking at commercial off-the-shelf technology computing products for use in space, whether it be in low Earth orbit, in geosynchronous orbit, or beyond into deep space. And this, you know, I had mentioned earlier when we talked before this phone call, I'd mentioned to you that if I had proposed putting such technology in space at Lockheed, I likely would not have been able to do that. There was not a vehicle within Lockheed to allow me to do such a thing at that point that I left. And then CASIS, the Center for the Advancement of Science in Space, they were very interested in this concept of looking at commercial off-the-shelf processors for use in space. And this is something, it's not only worth exploring, but there's a tremendous need for terrestrial-based computing power being in space for a whole host of reasons. And so that's also been driving these types of investigations.
So is the GumSticks, the board, is that, Ken, many people probably have heard of Raspberry Pis that you can get for projects and so forth on a consumer level. Is that the similar concept that on a small board it has all those components that you might need to work with, or is it something different?
It is very similar, yeah. It's so the nice thing about GumSticks is it's a very, very compact computing board. One of our collaborators has been John Sampson at Honeywell, who's recently retired from Honeywell but still is working on his dependable multiprocessor platform. And that's it's kind of like a supercomputing platform in space that uses many of these GumSticks in one single platform for use for kind of like a supercomputing in space.
Interesting. And so you applied, how soon after you started AMA or advanced materials applications, from that point to applying for the CASIS grant or application, submitting that, how long was in between there? Was that soon after you had started the company?
It was about 3 to 6 months after, and I'm trying to recall. There was two, they had an initial release of the request for proposal, and then they re-released it later. So I started initially, I think, 3 or 6 months from the time I started the company, and then later we had a final proposal.
And what you spelled out the CASIS as the Center for Advancement of Science and Space, but for those that may be listening that don't know, what is CASIS, and is it something that, like, they won that grant, and do you continue working with them? Is there, it's a partnership or collaboration? What is the organization?
It is another. It's another organization. They get funding through NASA, but they have basically money available for providing grants for testing technology on the International Space Station, and they test technology inside the International Space Station and then outside the space station, such as in the NanoRacks external platform that we're in, or our payload is in. So they provided us with a grant to basically develop the technology to do ground-based radiation testing, which we started with to look at which models of GumSticks would likely be reliable and robust in space. And then we built a payload that was then integrated by NanoRacks, which is a company that supports payload integration for payloads going into space, and in particular to be either inside or outside the International Space Station. So CASIS helped for us to interface with the payload integrator, which is NanoRacks, and also they would interface with NASA. NASA has a specific department. I don't recall its exact name. But basically, they are responsible primarily for the safety of the payloads that go onto the International Space Station, because they want to make sure there's no jeopardy to the ISS itself or to the astronauts on the ISS.
Sure.
So it was very helpful to have that mechanism in place, because when you're coming completely outside of the NASA ISS environment, there's a bit of a learning curve as to what they will tolerate. And so the thrust of CASIS, in large part, is to study novel technology and do novel science experiments on the International Space Station. And historically, aerospace, especially NASA, really prefers heritage technology that is very well tested. And so CASIS does the dance to integrate the newer technology, the innovative science projects onto the ISS with this ISS NASA culture, which is more geared towards risk, total risk aversion, or at least very hesitant of anything that would be risky. So it's an interesting dance.
Well, and this kind of goes to, you know, you and I had a prior conversation where you were talking about the heritage technology and that it, you know, and the players involved, and that it's not directly, you know, somebody sending something up to the International Space Station, them grabbing onto it and testing, that there are any number of players, and you just mentioned some of them in between that are allowing you to, or not allowing, but that are facilitating your technology to be able to get up there, CASIS, and then the companies that are actually, because it's a commercial venture that's actually carrying the payload, correct? It's not NASA itself anymore that's delivering payloads to the International Space Station, am I correct?
Well, yeah. So basically, in terms of the launch, so the integrator, NanoRacks, is a commercial company, and then SpaceX, who actually delivered the vehicle to the ISS back in July and August of last year. Of course, they're also a commercial group. So, yeah, there's a lot of interfacing commercial now with government agencies such as NASA.
Well, and that seems that it gives a great opportunity for other companies like yourself and people really wanting to experiment, develop exciting technologies to have those opportunities. And I guess in that experience, how has it been working with these various parties? Have they been cooperative? Has it been really seamless in working with NanoRacks and SpaceX and the different parties getting the product up to ISS?
It's still a challenge. I think generally there's been a lot of progress made compared to probably 10 years ago. I attended back a few years ago the ISS Research and Utilization Conference in Colorado, and big companies such as Boeing, Northrop, et cetera, would want to test, you know, significant payloads on the International Space Station, and that was very, very challenging. So the mechanisms of having a CASIS, having a NanoRacks, has really facilitated. It is not seamless. there are schedules. Sometimes there's new requirements that come to light. Sometimes things that didn't appear to be a red flag pop up as a red flag, and then you've got to work with it. So it's a lot of, as I think I mentioned in our previous phone call, my general approach and my understanding of an experience from working in aerospace is that you have to have a plan A, B, C, D, E, F, G,
right.
and be willing to be flexible. Generally, I think to do things that are not, is to do novel things, and this is true of a startup, is flexibility is an absolute must, and also holding on to your vision, especially if it's a vision that continues to make sense in the larger picture of things, that it'd be a great value to make the product, et cetera. But yeah, it was not seamless, and when you go through this set of obstacles or, you know, challenges that we had to put the gun sticks in space, when you go through that once or twice, you do learn a ton of things. So it does make the next time through much easier. But it's there's a lot of challenges, and we talked about this plan A, B, C, and D came up when we discussed the time, about 2 years, I believe, the time between we gave NanoRacks our payload, which sat on a shelf, I think, for about 2 years, because it was supposed to, it was scheduled to go up to earlier times. And both of those times, rockets exploded, and the payloads did not make it to the ISS. So, you know, it's definitely one of those areas that being absolutely flexible and also holding on to your vision and holding on to the faith that it will work out eventually, that's really important. But I do want to emphasize, and I didn't earlier, that for us to continue to march into space and deeper space, we have to be testing new technologies. And we, you know, the NASA's philosophy, at least of the past, was, you know, it was basically failure is not an option. And I just wanted to emphasize failure is an absolute necessary ingredient for the advancement of humans in space, for the advancement of exploration for space. And we've developed a product based on our understanding of gun sticks from ground-based radiation testing called the Resilient Affordable CubeSat Processor. And that computer is expected to go on the EM-1 mission, which will go outside the Earth Van Allen belts and head on its way between Earth and Mars. So, you know, our hope is to help contribute to us pushing further out and exploring as we are not going to be adverse to failing.
Right. And in talking about that and testing and knowing what works and doesn't work, I'd like to shift to the software and the testing. And bring Jeremy into the conversation. And so you have the technology out there and now and then other technology in the future. How do you run about testing whether it's working? Is the software on board there that's doing the testing, or are you getting remote information and doing the testing back here on the ground? How is that working?
Well, in the case of the GumSticks experiment, we did several things. The overall design is that. So I should preface this by saying that what we knew we were deploying that experiment into the NanoRack external platform, which at the time was brand new. We were literally one of the first the first set of experiments to ever go in there. So we knew there were a lot of unknowns and things that could potentially fail that we couldn't anticipate. So we really had to design things in mind, keeping that in mind and thinking about what redundancies we could build in. So the way to think about the experiment is it was going to run for 6 months and do a bunch of processing on the GumSticks computer on modules themselves. And it was going to produce some data that we wanted to see. And in the ideal world, we had several ways to get that data. There were four GumSticks modules in the payload, and then there was a fifth module that was a different SoC that was kind of a coordinator for everything in the experiment. So each of the GumSticks would run their workload and check the results of computations and things like that and log all of that data to a micro SD card that was connected to the GumStick. In addition, they would send that data to that that fifth processor, that coordinator, which would also log that data to a larger SD card it had available. So that gave us two points at which the data was going to be recorded. And then the third piece is that all of that data was also eligible to be broadcast on a data stream that would come from the ISS back down to Earth so that we could get data in semi-real time. And watch the progress of the experiment as it's orbiting Earth and things like that. So in the ideal world, if everything worked, we would you know have the experiment run, get the payload back after everything comes back to Earth, and we would have a copy of all the data on each of the GumSticks as well as an additional copy on that fifth processor, and we would have received most of that data in advance in real time while it was orbiting the Earth. Now, we knew that link between the ISS and Earth could be intermittent or that could fail entirely because a lot of this was new stuff that had been developed for the NanoRack's external platform. So we said, you know, that's nice to have, but we're not going to rely on it. So we're going to record all the data in the payload. And we know one of the GumSticks or multiple of the GumSticks possibly could fail or the SD card could fail. So we're going to make sure we've got at least one copy of all that data in the payload as well. So we really had to think about redundancy and make it so that if parts of the system failed, that the experiment could keep running in some mode, even if it was a degraded mode, so that we would have our best chance of getting the most data we could. Now, that said, we were benefiting from one thing that was pretty unique when it comes to testing in space, which is that we knew we were going to get the payload back as well. It's it gets installed into the external rack for a certain amount of time, and then eventually it comes back on a return from one of the SpaceX Dragon capsules, and then we can get the payload back and do additional testing on the ground to see if there's any degradation or things like that. So there was a lot that went into it, and a lot of it was just really thinking about failure modes and how to get the data even in the face of potential failures.
Which goes to, I think, the point that Kathleen was making to some extent, and that you've got to be thinking about all those different, you know, options A, B, C, D, and E, and anticipating the fact that there may in fact be failures, that there may be things that go wrong, and by that anticipation and learning when they do, you can better anticipate the next time. And have you been getting any of those results back? Do you have any of the results back from that first payload that went up?
Hey, Jeremy, do you want to touch base on that?
Yeah, we don't have any results back yet, unfortunately. As I mentioned, a lot of the technology up there that we were being deployed with was very new, and there was a problem with one of the connections in the external platform that resulted in our payload not being turned on. So it never received power, so it's up there orbiting the Earth in an unpowered state and will remain in an unpowered state until we get it back probably later this year.
I just got an update from Kirk at NanoRacks, and it looks like May we could get it back in a month or two. And the good news is that we actually saw stuck bits in RAM in our radiation testing, which is typically very undesirable for a computer. And this is when we were exposing it to a high intensity of proton radiation in our ground-based testing. So the good news is when the payload returns, hopefully in May, we will test the gun sticks and actually look for these stuck bits in RAM. So that will actually provide us with some valuable data on the performance of gun sticks that will actually be useful data, even though the gun sticks were not powered on. The gun sticks are still vulnerable to damage, power off. So, and we're also going to be talking with CASIS about reflying this experiment so we can evaluate the rate of single event effects on orbit for the gun sticks, and hopefully also including our newly developed computer, the Resilient Affordable CubeSat processor, in which we are planning on the stuck bits being an issue, and have integrated this in with ECC RAM and other measures to make that even a more robust platform using current generation system on chip technology.
Well, in talking about a question, if I could, talking about the fact that whether they were powered on or off, and in this case, unfortunately, powered off, collecting some of the data and seeing how whether there were any effects, because one of the things out there that I understand that you're testing for, or that is a problem, is radiation on the computing elements.
That's right.
So whether it's on or off, that same radiation coming through is affecting. Are there other things then? Is it mostly the environmental then you're seeing?
Yeah, so basically, if the payload had been powered on as it was designed to be powered on, we would have been monitoring the rate of single event effects, such as what's called latch up, which is when a high energy particle comes through the CMOS transistor technology and can cause a short circuit to occur in the computing elements. And the only way to mitigate that is to first detect that there's a latch up and then basically power down, do a hard reboot of the whole system. So our system was designed with, as Jeremy said, a fifth SoC. It would have been a watchdog, which would be looking for the event such as latch up. And then another kind of event that's, a couple of others. One is called a single event functional interrupt, and that's kind of like when a processor just hangs, so it no longer responds to inputs. And so we were also looking for that type of effect which we would see by the SOC no longer sending a heartbeat signal to the watchdog. So in that case, we'd also record the event and then do a hard reboot of the system and then power it back up. And then third, we were looking for single event upsets, which is when a typically when a memory element, such as you know, the element of RAM, when that has a flipped bit. So we were running continuously running calculations, and we were comparing it to a known value, a known standard. And so when those two values don't match up between the standard and what the computer's calculating, we know that there has been a flipped bit, which is also what we would see as a single event upset. And that would be also recorded in several different mechanisms, as Jeremy mentioned. So unfortunately, because the payload was not powered on due to some technology issues in the NREP, we will not have that specific data. However, equally valuable is the stuck bit on RAM, which is something we observed in ground-based testing, which will also we will observe if that's indeed an effect in the low Earth orbit. We'll observe that when these computers come back, we'll run memory tests on the RAM. And then if we see stuck bits, then we know that there was a permanent damage that was caused by the RAM for these modules when they were in space. So that's actually a very significant question that we will answer hopefully when we get these gun sticks back.
And then the answers to that question will then ideally lead to the improvement or betterment of technology that would be able to better withstand such events out in space.
That's right. And so what we did was we preemptively developed a platform, RACP, which will be able to tolerate stuck bits of RAM. And what our main focus was is to have redundant system-on-chip processors. And when one is seen to degrade in space, it's powered down and the next one in the array is powered up and takes over as the primary processor for space. And RACP is likely, it's basically going to be flying on the Miles spacecraft, which is currently ranked number one in the NASA CubeQuest, which is to send a 6U CubeSat out into deep space. And this satellite or this platform will be sending data back to Earth. And so RACP is to fly on that in that spacecraft, and it will be exposed to very high energy particles known as galactic cosmic rays. We know we'll be seeing single event effects, and we know that RAM would be susceptible to permanent damage in that environment. So this platform will be tested in even a more rigorous environment than low Earth orbit.
And when will that occur?
So I don't know the current date of the EM-1 launch, but that would occur, that would basically be going up with SLS-1, and I think that's going to be 2018. Okay. So that would be the plan for that vehicle.
Well, talking about 2018 and knowing that it's 2017 now, we can kind of move to somewhat of the end of our conversation, and I appreciate the time that you both have taken. But I want to, again, talking about 2018, I want to ask you both a question, and where do you see the future of space technology, commercial space exploration? Where do you see this going in the next 5, 10 years?
That's a great question. And I think, you know, Elon Musk has a very exciting view of the future. And there's many other commercial companies, private companies that also have an equally exciting vision of the future. He's talked about sending two people in basically a capsule to orbit the moon. And isn't that 2018, Jeremy?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, and that and their technology, of course, there is an element of heritage design and technology, but they're also using, I believe they're using more current computing technology as an example, and probably also more advanced materials than were used in the Apollo program. So that's just a good reminder of how far private and commercial technology is taking us to explore new worlds. So I don't think it'll be long after that they actually launch and land a vehicle on the moon, and very close behind them, if not in step with them at some point, is Blue Origin. And that's for manned missions. CubeSat missions using a CubeSat that's 6U or 12U, they're already planned to go to Mars. And we've actually talked with one of the groups at JPL about integrating our computing platform into vehicles that will be going to Mars and even landing on Mars. So this is just a few years away. So we're progressing very quickly and making, I think, very fast progress. And NASA is playing a tremendously supportive role, providing companies with their understanding of what designs work, which technology works, and also being very open to assisting with testing and promoting through grants and other mechanisms, funding commercial and private industry to take the risk and to potentially fail. So I think what you're seeing is only going to the advancement of technology into space. And I think we're going to the moon and then soon to Mars after that. So and this is within the next 10 years.
And it's,
Yeah,
and it's going from not just words to people actually making these things happen, which is just incredibly exciting. Jeremy, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I was just going to point out that, you know, one of the great things we're finally seeing, which hasn't been the case in the sort of space business for a long, long time now, is we're finally seeing competition and the actual benefits from competition, because we have SpaceX, we have ULA, and soon Blue Origin all starting to offer launch services, and there are going to be additional providers coming along for launch services for at least small satellites and CubeSats. And so that's going to do what competition always does, which is going to bring the price down so far that a whole bunch of other business possibilities are going to open up that were simply out of reach before. So you see, even nowadays, we have companies like Planet Labs, which was putting up these flocks of satellites to do Earth observation and to capture, you know, images of the Earth every 24 hours. So we would have, you know, this unprecedented view of what's going on the planet. And that wasn't even feasible 10 years ago. And so I think once this competition has really taken hold and the launch prices are continuing to come down, there's going to be a lot more funding that goes into businesses that have a component that involves putting satellites up in Earth orbit and eventually sending vehicles around the moon and to Mars and other places. So it's hard to say what the next 10 years are going to look like, but I think we can all agree that it's going to be a lot more active than the last 10 or 20 or even 30 years have been when it comes to space technology and exploration.
And it provides, just based on what both of you have said, it provides opportunities, any number of opportunities for individuals to become involved in those endeavors. And that kind of brings us to the last point that I'd want to address or talk about. And it kind of is circling back to how we began. Kathleen, you were talking about going outside and looking to the stars with your father. And I really do mean that you are one of those that are pushing the boundaries and pursuing your dreams and making it happen, because here you are now with Yosemite Space and sending things into space. And so talking about the future, talking about the opportunities for other young girls and boys, men and women, what would you tell them? What for those students or the parents of students out there that might listen to this program, What kind of advice or thoughts can you provide them?
I would always follow your dreams. If you find an area that you have great passion for, I would not worry about how you're going to make a living out of it. And I wouldn't listen to those who dismiss your dreams, your goals. I think you hold steadfast to what you want to create. And like I said, you have to be flexible, A, B, C, D, all those different plans, and be open to things showing up for you. I didn't even know about CASIS before I applied, you know, until I had gotten that phone call, and my goodness, what an opportunity that was. So I think you just have to have faith that you will figure it out. But the first and foremost thing is to follow your passion. And I don't think it can sometimes lead to barriers and stumbling points of stumbling, but you have to have the faith that you'll figure it out, figure out your way around. And to parents, the main thing is support your children's dreams and their goals, and don't worry about things being practical. You know, everything, our world is changing right now, and, you know, everyone's going to have to be flexible. A lot of industry jobs are going away and being replaced by automation. So the whole landscape is changing. And so, you know, coming up with ideas, pursuing things that you're interested in will always be a benefit.
Fantastic. Jeremy, do you have any comments before we get to the conclusion here?
Yeah, I would mostly just echo what Kathleen said, and also say, you know, it's for parents talking to their kids. It's like just think of how things have changed in your lifetime so far. The rate of technology change we've seen in the last 15, 20, 30 years is the kind of thing that if you were to go back in a time machine and tell people what was going to exist, the vast majority of them wouldn't believe you. And it's like even in the industry I've been in for 15 years now, it's mind-boggling to see what's happened. And you know, just try to explain and impart that to their kids and help them to understand that that really the biggest limiting factor to what the future is going to hold is their imagination. So let it run wild.
And I'll echo your last comment. And I think the question is not what is possible. The question is what is not possible.
I think that's well said. And, you know, I think that, you know, Kathleen, you mentioned an application, and I wanted to bring this up before the show ended. But to think even 10 years ago in talking about exoplanets and being able to identify other planets that might out there or be out there in the universe was a bit of a distant dream. There were technologies, there were things developing and to kind of detect things. But now you turned me on to this application through JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, that is available online. And we will make sure to provide a link on the webpage for this particular show. But can you just, final comments, can you tell me what that application is about, where you're actually able to, I think, click on particular, not just like planets in our own solar system, but actually stars and looking at stars into the future and pulling in and zooming in and seeing other planets. Is that correct? Am I describing it right?
I was incredibly impressed when I found this application off of JPL's website. There's a group at JPL that did an extraordinary job of pulling in all the data that we're receiving on exoplanets and the stars that is their main star in each of their respective solar systems. And they consolidated all this data, and then they put it into an application in which it allows you to see which planets are closest to our own planet in these different, you know, these stars that are 50 light years away or further. And it allows you to see how that solar system compares to the size of our own. It gives you a map of the habitable zone in which water remains liquid in each of these other solar systems. It gives you a description of what the surface of the planet looks like. And so what it did is they put together this huge database of information, which by itself may seem abstract and cumbersome. It makes it not only digestible, but very exciting to the explorer in each of us. And it makes the idea of even going to another planet in another solar system, it starts to make that a more tangible idea. And I've never seen anything like this before, and it's so exciting. We are not unique in this galaxy and in this universe. We're one of many, many, many habitable areas. And so, you know, like I said, the question is not what is possible. I think the question is what is not possible. And so I applaud JPL for putting that together, because it really is extraordinary, and it really is very inspirational to the explorer in each one of us.
I couldn't have said it better, and I really appreciate your comments. I appreciate both of you taking the time out of your busy schedules to be with us here on STEM Voices. To be honest with you, I could talk for hours, continue talking about all these different subjects, but I know that you have places to be, I have places to be, so hopefully we'll be able to have you back and return at a later time. But for now, I really want to thank you and appreciate both of you being there. And I cut you off, Kathleen, you were saying something.
Oh, that's okay. No, we've enjoyed this too. Thank you for giving us the opportunity.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thanks,
it's my pleasure. Jeremy, Kathleen, thanks so much. We'll be in touch. And as I said, we'll hope to have you back on STEM Voices. Have a great day.
You too.
Thank you.
When kids drink Soda Pop, they're getting a lot more than they bargained for, because just one soda a day can lead to an extra 10 pounds a year. And that leads to some very serious health problems. But the soda tax can make a difference, reducing the epidemic of childhood obesity and diabetes, with the money helping to support Cook County hospitals and health programs. The soda tax. It's going to help keep our kids a lot healthier. Paid for by Michael R. Bloomberg.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.